Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Best-selling author Connie Zweig is a retired psychotherapist who has reimagined age. She is a former executive editor at Jeremy Tarcher Publishing, a former columnist for Esquire magazine, and contributor to the LA Times. In her latest book, Dr. Zweig says, with extended longevity comes the opportunity for extended growth and spiritual development. Her book is entitled, The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul. Connie Zweig, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. Thank you for having me.
Well, your title itself raises questions, I think. Somebody looks at the title and says, the inner work of age. What do you mean by that, Connie?
Yes, it does, I think, raise questions because it hasn't been framed that way before. What I'm suggesting is that in our culture, we don't have any guidance for moving into the later stages of life beyond midlife. We don't really have any tools or practices. Even most therapists are not trained for this. And so what I discovered in interviewing hundreds of people for the book is that there are a set number of inner obstacles that we have. I call them shadows, but they're unconscious inner obstacles. And each of those has a practice to break free of it. So the inner work is about identifying, making conscious those inner obstacles, and then doing the practice that allows you to move past it and become an elder.
Well, the subtitle of the book, so The Inner Work of Age, and the subtitle, Shifting from Role to Soul. Now, do people understand what you mean by that, Connie?
I don't know if they intellectually understand, but here's what I'm finding, Nancy. Hundreds of people are reaching out to me, and many of them are commenting on the subtitle because it speaks to something intuitive in them that speaks to this sense or this feeling or intuition that it's time to move beyond our roles. They tend to fall away naturally anyway. Our work roles, our relationship roles change, even our family roles change. And then what? And so people are asking, what's next? And when they see role to soul, they can imagine a spiritual shift in awareness, a shift in identity from what they do to who they really are.
My guest is Dr. Connie Zweig. She is a retired psychotherapist, and she has written a book, The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul. And one thing you ask your clients to do, because you were a psychotherapist before you retired, is you ask people to consider a life review. And I found it was interesting what you had to say when you reviewed your own, when you did your own life review, because it set me thinking about, oh, yeah, I had similar experiences. At one point in your book, you say that life events had a rhyme and rhythm of their own. And I think if people do a life review, maybe they can see the truth in that statement in your book, Connie. So what did you learn when you made your own life review?
What a beautiful question. So there were several important findings or discoveries for me. I'm not a person who focuses on the past. I'm not sort of naturally nostalgic or looking back. And so I had some resistance to doing this, but I made such incredible discoveries that I wanted to share that with people. So the first thing is that the traditional life review is about the ego's story. And it's the story that we tell ourselves over and over again. This was my life. This happened and that happened, and I met this person, and this person mentored me, and this person hurt me or traumatized me. And this is the story we tell ourselves. And it's important as we age to begin to get free of the past so that we can live fully here now. So this is one of the practices for doing that. And what I found when I did that, actually there were, I'll mention two different things. One is that I found that the people who I thought betrayed me and disappointed me were actually initiating me out of my immaturity and naivete into what I call the shadow, the dark side of human beings. And that if I hadn't had those experiences, I would have had a very different life. I would not have been led to become, quote, the shadow expert and write Meeting the Shadow, Romancing the Shadow, and now this new book, which is all about the shadows of age. So those hurtful, even heartbreaking experiences actually led me, shaped my destiny in a way. And then I also saw, it wasn't that they weren't difficult, I don't want to minimize them, but I saw a meaning in them that I hadn't seen before. And the other thing I discovered was that I had four distinct careers, Nancy, and I thought they were very different. I was a meditation teacher when I was young, and then a journalist, and then a book editor for a publishing house, an author, and then a therapist. And what I saw was that they all had an underlying theme, which is transmitting information about consciousness. And that theme I saw was my soul's mission. It was beyond the ego story. And it was actually, you know, you can call it Dharma or Tao or any of a number of names that make sense to you. I called it my soul's mission because I felt like it was the story that was running underneath my ego's story. And it was very fulfilling to identify that.
You know, as I said, as I was reading your life review, I saw instances too, in my own case, that kind of indications that you're on the right track, maybe, because I've been teaching yoga for decades. And as an undergraduate, I love biology, languages, and they seem so far apart from each other. But yet when I became a yoga teacher and I studied Sanskrit because I loved reading the Vedas and the Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita. So there was a relationship there. And I never applied for a yoga job. I was always asked. I would show up and they would say, oh, our yoga teacher just left. Would you teach yoga? So that was a part of this statement when you say events had a rhyme and rhythm of their own. It's kind of like you just follow. Often it's a body sensation. I've had that happen. A lot of times you put somebody behind a microphone and they stiffen and tense. And I remember being called in to just record a little something with the manager years ago. And my body just softened and relaxed. I almost slid out of the chair. I thought, my goodness, my body's telling me I feel at home behind a microphone, a radio microphone. And so I think that too is what maybe you experienced.
Well, you know, we're guided by all kinds of intuitions, and people who are body-centered have the experience that you're describing. I've heard that from a lot of people. People who are more emotional, feeling-centered check in with their feelings for guidance. People who are more intuitive might hear a voice or see an image or just have a vague sense of something to guide them. But what's important to say is that there's a lot of noise inside our minds that's blocking this intuitive guidance. There's a lot of noise in the world now that we're internalizing. You know, it's hard to tell how much is inside and outside because it's so noisy now. And so my method of shadow work offers people a way to identify what's the noise and what's the signal. What's a shadow character and what's your intuitive guidance or your deeper knowing? And that seems to me like such an important gift to have at this stage of life when we recognize that there's not a lot of time left. We have a a limited time horizon, and we really want to check in and attune to ourselves and ask, what is this time about? What do I need to do now that nobody else can do, or give that no one else can give? What do I want to offer so that I won't die with regret? And to do that, we have to be able to receive what you're describing, the guidance from within. And that means we have to really be able to differentiate the signal from the noise.
I think that's not always easy to do, because if you get this kind of subtle hint, you think, was that my imagination? Was I just wishing that would be the case? Or is this an intuition I should follow and that's legitimate? Do you have people present that problem to you, Connie?
Yes, very much so. I think there's a learning process in trusting our intuition and knowing where it's coming from. You know, is this a message from my soul, or whatever we call it, from spirit, from self, my higher self? Is this a message from the transpersonal source? Or is this, you know, the ego's agenda? Or is this a shadow character trying to sabotage me? And we need time for self-reflection in order to make that discrimination. You know, in yoga, and you probably know this, I'm sure, one of the schools is discrimination, one of the schools of yoga, learning how to know the difference between this and that, not this, not that. And there's a way in which this is like a yoga practice. Is this my higher self, or is this the shadow character that I internalized from my father or from my mother? Or is this, you know, and so I think this, in some ways, it's like a meditation practice or a yoga practice, because it's very much about learning to tune within and recognize that distinction.
We're going to take a break, and then Dr. Connie Zweig and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with best-selling author Connie Zweig, and her book is entitled The Inner Work of Age. And Connie, reading your book, I felt like, oh, readers of your book can get a psychotherapy session just for the price of your book. If they follow the advice that you offer. And for example, one of the things that you suggest in your book is that people use visualizations. And in your chapter, Elder with a Thousand Faces, you describe one of your clients and what you ask him to try, and us, the reader, too. You suggest that we also try this. And this client was named Craig. And I'd like for you to tell us, what did you ask Craig to do?
Well, this is very related to what you and I were just talking about. So there's one guided visualization in the book. It comes from Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who was a mystical rabbi and one of the founders of the conscious aging movement. And I borrowed this from his book. And it's a visualization to contact your own inner elder. And that's the part of us that is the higher self. That's the part of us that has this guidance, Nancy, that's waiting for us. You know, you've heard of the inner child. That's a really common archetype.
In fact, I liked your inner elder so much better because that inner child that was popular for a while just didn't resonate with me because I thought, well, what about young, like children that have an inner elder? And that's why I like your metaphor here.
Yeah. So these archetypes are within all of us at every age of our lives. So the inner child is still in us, you and me. It just begins to take a back seat. Unless sometimes when I'm playing with my grandkids, I can feel that part of me. But most of the time, it's not central. But the inner elder is less known. And that's the name that I'm giving for what we were talking about a minute ago, the intuitive voice of the self, the higher self or spirit within us. So I asked this client, and I write about this in the book, to sit down and center himself for a few minutes by following his breath. And then imagine that he's climbing a stair to a doorway, and the inner elder greets him there and gazes into his eyes, and he feels totally loved. And the client asks a question for guidance. So this is an intentional way to get that guidance we were talking about. And then after posing the question, he remains receptive, allowing the answer to really fill him and be embodied. And then the higher self or the inner elder says to him, "Journey on with confidence and blessings, and visit me again whenever you wish." And so when my client did this, he did it at home, and then he came back to my office. And he said, "I didn't believe you. You know, I was very skeptical about this." He said, "But I saw an old Native American man with a long braid and deep wrinkles. He was wrapped in a blanket and his eyes pierced me. I asked him what to do with my life now that I'm not young and not old. I asked him about my mission for this time, and he replied, the inner elder replied to Craig, 'The war is over. Put down your weapons, your strategies, your shields. Grieve your losses and learn to trust that something larger is carrying you. The rest will take care of itself.'" Craig sat with his hands in his lap and we were silent for a while. And then he asked, "Is that man me? Did I know that?" So this, yes.
That this, the inner elder is a latent blueprint that dwells within us, waiting to greet us, waiting to guide us. And when you're telling this story, you ask him, I might remind people that this is Dr. Connie Zweig, reading from her book, The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul. And some years ago, I became a pilgrim. And you use this in, when your instructions to him, you say, "As a pilgrim confronting the highest, most all-embracing source of wisdom, ask the inner elder for guidance about the issues that puzzled you." And when you use that word pilgrim, that resonated with me because I was reluctant. I walked the Camino de Santiago because I thought I was doing it for somebody else. And it was really life-changing for me. You get up in the morning, you walk through, and first thing you do, you climb a mountain, literally. Most people start at that point in the Pyrenees. And I was out in nature with no agenda. There was nothing I could accomplish other than just put one foot instead in front of the other. And that really was life-changing for me. Somebody was always pushing myself to accomplish. And here, it didn't matter whether you got there. And so this image, when you use that word pilgrim, I thought, yes, I felt like I was a pilgrim. I wasn't a hiker. I never was a hiker. It's one reason I resisted. But I said, yes, I am a pilgrim. And I think that image helps serve in other ways too.
I really like that. I really like that. I think we all become pilgrims in this stage of life. And what are we, what is the destination of our pilgrimage? So the book is really about how to let go and step into the unknown and emerge renewed. That's what the practices are for. So the pilgrimage is that whole process. And what is the destination of the pilgrimage? When you were speaking, I was seeing in my mind's eye a labyrinth. We are circling a center. We're circling, it's like circumambulation of the center. And we may never get there. And some people will. Some people will have a powerful experience of their own center, connected to their own transpersonal source. And this can be a shift in awareness, like role to soul. And later in the book, I explore higher stages of consciousness and practices, you know, for cultivating them. But this image of a pilgrim on the labyrinth doing that circular, or maybe spiraling is actually a better metaphor, but spiraling toward the center is a beautiful way of describing the journey in this stage of life.
You know, at one point you quote somebody who says, it all seemed so important at the time. And at this stage in my life and reading your book, I think about things that all seemed so important at the time. And now I realize, no, I can let that go. And it was not easy for me to make that shift of seeing value in being and not doing. And at one point in your book, you say that the shadow character might say, well, if you're being instead of doing, you're being a slug.
Right.
So for that reason, I love an expression. I don't know if you've ever heard of it in Italian, dolce far niente. Dolce, sweet, far niente, doing nothing. In other words, doing nothing is not being a slug. It's sweet. Dolce far niente. Sweet, doing nothing. So sometimes people ask, well, what are you going to do today? And I said, I'm going to try to dolce far niente, because it's not easy for me to do nothing, but I'm learning that at this stage in my life.
So let's do some yoga of discrimination again, right? So doing nothing doesn't mean, because people are listening, they're having associations. What does doing nothing mean? Watching TV, being a couch potato, sitting on email all day. What does doing nothing mean? And everyone will have their own associations to that. That's not what I'm talking about. Or it might mean, let's take retirement as an example. So retirement is like a Rorschach test. People project or fantasize onto it. You know, I'll be able to do nothing. I'll be carefree. I'll have leisure. Or I'll take a lot of cruises, right? Or I'll volunteer, or they fantasize, you know, I'll work for that charity, or I'll raise the grandkids, or I'll read a lot. So that doing nothing is like an opposite of doing everything. So in our culture, we're raised, you know, in this hero's journey to do everything, to build an empire, to have a career, to serve the family, to build a financial foundation, you know, to help society and those in need, to fix ourselves. And so doing everything then becomes doing nothing. And that's not what I'm saying. What I'm talking about, and the shadow character is called the doer. One of my clients called it the driver, the provider, the competitor, the dominator. Archetypally, we could call it the hero on the hero's journey. So what I'm talking about with retirement as an example, the end of paid work, people ask, what are you going to do, right? Because it's a doing culture. We worship doing. What are you going to achieve? What are you going to produce? And so then we think that's who we are. I am what I do. I am my success, right? And then we retire. And what happens to that doing everything? Some people can fall into doing nothing as a kind of reactivity, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about self-reflection, making the space to really reflect on your life and distill the lessons learned, emotional repair, so that you reconcile relationships that may need to give and receive forgiveness, spiritual repair, so that you clarify your values and beliefs as you approach death, the work of life completion. So this is not doing nothing, it's inner work. And so somebody watching you may say, it looks like you're doing nothing because you're sitting on the couch, right?
Yeah.
But that's not what I'm talking about. And even finding a meditation practice and sitting. So big doers will say that's doing nothing. I don't believe that for a minute.
My guest is best-selling author Connie Zweig, and her new latest book is The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul. And this word role, what came to mind as you were talking about doing nothing, is a role model that in the past, I don't think I would have considered a role model, is a friend who is content to do nothing. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want to cultivate, this contentment with doing nothing. So I have a new role model, which fits in with what you're saying, I think, in your book. You also say that elder is a stage, not an age. And I think most people would say, oh, elder, that's an age. You also capitalize the word elder in your book. Why do you do that?
Because it's an archetype. And I want to draw attention to the nobility of it and the sacred power of it. You know, when I spoke about my client, Craig, it was not surprising to me that the inner elder who showed up for him was Native American, because the indigenous populations here in the States honor elders and revere them and have all kinds of rites of passage to become an elder, and traditions around elder storytelling and teaching multiple generations. And so in our kind of post-industrial, post-modern Caucasian mainstream society, we don't have that. And so elder is a stage, not an age. What I mean by that is, at 65, we all get a Medicare card. And we become a senior. That's all we get in our society. But becoming a senior, an age, doesn't reflect our stage of development. You can become a senior and be very close-minded and rigid and full of regret. And that's not what I would call an elder. So an elder is connected to something beyond ego, something larger than him or herself. An elder has a compassionate heart and a certain kind of self-awareness. I call it shadow awareness. And an elder also has mortality awareness. Elders are not in denial of death, like so much of our culture is. So an elder emerges intentionally, with intentional development, or what I'm calling inner work. Does that make the distinction?
Yes, because that's the subtitle of your book, Shifting, making that shift from the role that you've, say, achieved, I'm going to use that word achieved, in midlife, to focusing on your soul And this is why you call it the inner work of age. And you do call it work. So you're encouraging us to work at this, right, Connie?
Well, I've actually had some complaints about that word because I use shadow work and inner work and spiritual work. I don't know of a better word. I mean, one word is practice, which some people like better. But it's not homework. It's not tedious. It's not obligatory. It's a choice. It's a choice to learn about yourself and to learn about others. It's a choice to explore your history and let go of the past. It's a choice to mine your shadow, what was lost in your lifetime to the unconscious, and perhaps reclaim some of that material now. Like, for example, creativity. I have so many people tell me that they were not able to pursue music or painting or writing because it was forbidden in their families, and then it wasn't possible while they were raising a family. And so that becomes an opportunity now. And so, you know, and someone may only realize that through the inner work. So work, inner work, it's a tricky term, but don't let it put you off.
Well, what brought to my mind too, when you talk about people, when they reach this point, they can turn their attention to being creative, doing what they really love, their passions. And I happen to know a cardiologist who, I just imagine that his parents said, now we want you to be a doctor, because that's what he did, like a good son. Now, this is my view of it. But what he really loved was opera. And he devoted himself to that in his spare time. And I'm hoping that he has continued to do that, and that other people, maybe the people who read your book, will say, well, why do I need to wait until I become an elder? Or why do I need to wait till I retire? Why don't I start thinking about who I really am and practicing my creativity now?
Yes, all of this is applicable at any age. I had a 30-year-old who read the book send me an email saying it's totally changed the way he's going to age in his life. So it isn't only for people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. That the inner work in those years has the context of impending death. And that changes it. You know, that changes it from when you're in your 30s and 40s and you're not really considering mortality. But in general, the work can be done by anyone in any generation.
In fact, your book, A Radical Reimagining of Age for All Generations, mm-hmm. from your work.
Yeah.
Is there any parting thoughts you want to leave your listeners with, Connie?
You know, this extended longevity that we have between retirement and the end is unprecedented. It's never happened before in human history. And so that helps us understand why there's no guidance, why there's no rite of passage, why there's no knowledge of the practices that we need to do, because it's never happened before. But what I'm suggesting is that it's an invitation. You can open this invitation to do some inner work during this time, and the treasures of late life will come to you.
Thank you, Connie.
Thank you.
The book, again, is The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul. The author is best-selling author Connie Zweig, who is a retired psychotherapist. After a break, outdoor adventurer Kurt Kunz tells us what he discovered in Rishikesh, India. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today has always been an adventurer. Kurt Kuntz learned to love the outdoors growing up in Boise, Idaho. After a successful career in sales, he retired early to seek new meaning in life. In 2012, he walked the Camino de Santiago de Compostela across Spain. This long, transformative journey on foot inspired Kurt Kuntz to write his first book, A Million Steps, a memoir that forged friends and connections around the world. One of those friends led Kurt to Rishikesh, India, where he began to study yoga as a physical and spiritual practice. Kurt Kuntz has now written a book about his adventures in India entitled Practice. Kurt Kuntz, welcome.
Nancy, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, people might wonder, if you have had all these adventures, you're probably asked to give speeches. What do people ask you to give talks to their groups?
Yeah, they do. I give quite a few talks, and I really enjoy it. That one-on-one connection with people, you can feel the energy and passion in the room. And yeah, I really enjoy doing that.
What kind of things do they want to hear from you? What about your adventures or your expertise do they want to know about?
What I really try to encourage people to do is to break their routines and to understand that nothing happens inside of a comfort zone as far as personal growth is concerned. So I try to use some examples that I've had in life and then try to really encourage people to, you know, possibly wake up today and think about doing something different than they did yesterday, which is the only way you'll really find some growth and hopefully a little more happiness.
Well, now, you're a successful businessman, and then you decide to walk a pilgrimage across Spain. What made you decide to do that?
Well, I actually checked out of business quite a number of years before that. I graduated college in 1986, and then I went to work for a company called Micron Technology, which is in my hometown of Boise, Idaho, and I was in sales there. And in the year 2000, I just kind of had an epiphany and said, there has to be more to life than kind of working for the proverbial man. And I decided that I would step back. And I thought, I'm just going to see if I can't work for a little while and see how that goes. And I never went back. And it's not a story of, you know, checking out with millions of dollars and I hit, you know, Google at the right time or something like that. I've always lived, you know, within my means. And I've just found that adventures in life are much more important. And so I started that really in the year 2000. And I started to take more and more journeys. And I would say really the most significant journey of my life was the 2012 walk in Santiago, just Santiago on the Camino, which both you and I have done. And it was, I mean, every adventure has kind of sculpted my life. That was a life-bending trip, and that resulted in my first book. And oh my gosh, I'm so thankful for that that walk.
My guest is pilgrim Kurt Kuntz. His first book was about his walking the pilgrimage. It was called A Million Steps. And Kurt, you mentioned that I walked this pilgrimage too. And so a paragraph in your book just rang so true to me. It reflected my experience as a pilgrim. And I know people who haven't done this think, oh my goodness, that can't be true. But here's what you wrote. While walking along the Camino de Santiago, every day was filled with the unknown. I had no idea of the upcoming terrain, no reservations for sleeping, no walking partner. I did have a walking partner myself, but, and absolutely no control over the weather. As I let go of my need to control, synchronicity seeped into my life. I began to develop a faith that things would work out. I saw that if someone twisted an ankle on this path, the next pilgrim could easily be an orthopedic surgeon from the Mayo Clinic. As I tried new things, I also gave up my attachment to the outcome. And this sounds just like, oh, that can't be true. You're walking along, you sprain your ankle, and here's an orthopedic surgeon from the Mayo Clinic coming up behind you. But that happened so many times. This young pilgrim was walking so that his feet hurt. And my partner and I asked him, you know, you're what's your problem? And he said, well, I've been camping outdoors where I've got a lot of rain, and my shoes, he had on leather shoes, he said, just didn't dry out, and my feet just are soaking wet. So when he took off his shoes, his feet were in really bad shape. But guess what? The person looking at his feet was a nurse. And so other pilgrims said, well, I've got some gauze, and I've got some tape, and I've got some antiseptic. And all these pilgrims gathered around to support this young man. And I thought, so many pilgrims, so many other people have helped me along the way, that here's maybe a chance for me to help a fellow pilgrim. And all I did was hold his foot while other people wrapped it and took care of it. And then he said, and I was so touched. And he said, you know, I prayed about this last night. So we other pilgrims were the answer to his prayer. And often it's not even thought about. You just, when you need something, somebody is there to supply that need. I know it sounds crazy, but that was my experience too.
It's an amazing place to be, Nancy, and we're both very lucky to have experienced that walk. I don't think it was, for me, a really good training ground to attach myself to the moment. And I believe that when you do get involved in the moment, that the synchronicities that are around everybody all the time, you're not aware of them because you're in the past, you're in the future, and you're not, it's kind of like your receptiveness to these synchronicities are not there. So when I walked the Camino, I just had synchronicity after synchronicity. It just was like raindrops falling out of the sky. There were so many of them. And where I've taken that into my life 8 years later, I find now that I take synchronicities for granted and they happen all the time. And when I find they're not happening, that's when I stop and I go, what am I doing wrong? Because they're always around me and they've gone away right now. And I figure it's something I do. So I shift my energy, my attitude, or whatever it may be. And if those synchronicities are not coming down in my life constantly, I'm doing something wrong. And I believe they're out there for everybody all the time.
You know, one time I thought, we never had to sleep outdoors, but we were prepared because you don't know, you don't have reservations. And the one time I thought, well, I guess this is the time, because the hostel was full and there was nobody in this little town. But this lady showed up and came to our rescue. Oh my gosh, who would have never dreamed that that's how we would be rescued. Well, now you make this trip on the Camino, but what made you decide to go to India?
Well, I think every decision you make in life ultimately comes out and there's a new manifestation that happens based on a previous decision. So I decided to walk the Camino in 2012. I then wrote a book about it and I ended up doing a number of speeches. And during one of those speeches, there was a guy just in an audience who was sitting close to me, and I started talking to him and talked about the Camino. And he said, hey, there's a lady I know who's very much into the Camino. And it turned out it was a mutual friend of ours just through Facebook. I didn't really know this woman very well, but we had at least, you know, we're Facebook friends. And she was in India, and she was in an ashram in a city called Rishikesh. And I didn't know what an ashram is. I didn't know what Rishikesh was. And India was never on my radar. And I just reached out to her and said, hey, our mutual friend Brian is a great guy. And she said, yeah, I've read your book and I walked the Camino and blah, blah, blah. And about a week later, out of the blue, she sent me a note and said, Kurt, I know you travel a lot. I really feel that you need to come to India and come to Rishikesh. And it was kind of like a lock going, or a key going into the lock. I just immediately felt yes. And I pulled up on Rishikesh because I knew nothing about it. And it said the city was about 100,000 people. And I thought, well, that sounds better than, you know, one of these Indian cities with 20 gazillion people. And so I like the size. It's right on the Ganges River and about 30 miles from the headwaters. It's at the base of the Himalayan mountains. And so I'm going, that sounds good. And then the city is referred to as the yoga capital of the world. And I had just a few years prior to that started to get a very novice yoga practice, but something I was doing with some regularity. And then my favorite part was I don't know if you remember, but the Beatles took an iconic trip to India a long
time ago. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's where they went. They went to Rishikesh. And I just said, my gosh, if it's good enough for, you know, all these stars lined up, I'm going. And so I took my first trip. And the first time I went for 6 weeks and lived in an ashram, did yoga, did everything you would do in India. And it was an exceptional experience. But had I not walked the Camino and not written the Camino book and not done the Camino speeches, there's no way it would have ever happened. So it's just a continuation of the journey that unfolds.
My guest is Kurt Kuntz. He is a pilgrim, a yogi, and an author. Now, he, you mentioned the Beatles going to India, and in your book, you reproduce some artwork, and on one page, you have Beatles Ashram Art, and it's under the section. Some of your sections are more like essays. It's not like chronologically, I did this, and the next day I did that, and this little chapter, this essay, explains a question people may have come up in their mind saying, well, how do you just pick up and go? What about your spouse? What about your children? You just leave and go wherever you want to go? And you kind of explain that. You start by talking about when you were in your early teens, you expected to have, you know, get married, have children. And did that turn out?
Well, I think it turned out I didn't take the traditional route. as you just mentioned there, I really thought when I was younger that, you know, working for a big corporation, and I thought, like a lot of, you know, people in my family, that I would just ultimately get married and it just naturally would have children and all these things would happen. And it really didn't. And there's another side to that that I talk about in these books. I had some alcohol trouble. And I think that when you have alcohol issues, I think you're not really as open to relationships as you should be at all. And so I don't think I was really a great candidate for it at that time in my 20s and in early 30s. And then I quit all that. But I've ended up, I'm not married and I don't have any children. I've had some incredible women in my life for long periods of time, but I've just never ended up being married. And I like the free spirit of being able to move around and kind of, you know, like the India trip. I mean, I get a Facebook message that says, you need to come to India. And I just said yes and went. And there's a tremendous freedom that comes without having the normal traditional attachments that people have, being with family and you know, wife, children, et cetera. And so it's a different lifestyle, but some of my friends go, gosh, I mean, you must be so unhappy because he just doesn't have these things. And, you know, there's pros and cons to everything in life. To be able to, you know, to hop on a plane and go somewhere and do what you want to do is pretty liberating. And, ironically, my mother is, she's recently become a widow from my stepfather, and she's terrified of being alone. And I think I've been alone for such a long time that I may have crossed that watermark where I may just, you know, end this way. But I'm open to everything. And it's just, I think that's the answer to everything. Say yes to every experience, and just go with the flow, man.
Well, you also remark in your book, and I bet people wonder, well, Kurt, maybe you're using travel as an excuse to avoid intimate relationships.
Well, maybe I am. I really don't know the answer.
You just say in your book, I'm a single guy who has no plans beyond 6 months and who usually spends 6 months of the year traveling. And you say, maybe I'm hiding behind borders. But you say, you know, you're looking ahead 6 months, but it doesn't sound like you're ruling out some kind of intimate relationship that would be close to somebody. It's just that you're saying at this moment, right now, you're content with your life as it is.
I am very content. And it really began, the first journey I did was a bike trip through Europe, and it was in 2006. And I literally landed at the Amsterdam airport with a bicycle and two panniers and, you know, a couple of pairs of socks and stuff. And I had no map or anything. And I rode 2,000 miles. I took the trains 2,000 miles. And I didn't have a map. I'd wake up and say, I'm going to go to the city, and then I think I can make this one. And I rode through 9 countries, and I've been, I think it was 40 plus cities, and it was just an incredible trip. And then, you know, at the trip, I met friends from the world. And then I started to go to Costa Rica, and I have friends in Costa Rica. And then I started to go to India, and the first India trip didn't end in one trip. It ended up 5 trips. So in the past 5 years, I've spent 6 months of my life in India. And now I have a bunch of friends in India. And the city I'm in now is only 150 miles away from my home in Boise, but I'm in a city that's called Sun Valley, Idaho. And I have a community of friends up here. And I just find these pockets of communities of really good, interesting, and they're very diverse people. One of my best Indian friends, a 26-year-old woman. Another one of my favorite Indian friends is, I think he's 70 years old, and he's just a great human being. Up here in the community I'm in now, the other night I had also with some fellow pilgrims, we had a barbecue, 4 generations, 96-year-old matriarch of the family and the great-grandchildren, 5 years old and 7 years old. I couldn't have scripted a better day than that.
Well, let me remind listeners that the title of your newest book is Practice. The author is Kurt Kuntz. So thank you, Kurt, for being a guest today.
Oh, thank you so much, Nancy. I really appreciate it. And I feel honored to be a second-time guest on your program. And I've enjoyed talking to you offline, too.
And I'd also like to thank my first guest, Connie Zweig, author of The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.